99 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
With Juan McCartney is sponsored by Commonwealth Bank, Burger King, CFAL, Rods Electric Motors, Fidelity Bank Bahamas, Wendy's, J.S. Johnson, BTC, the Pan American Health Organization, NUA Insurance Agents and Brokers, Kelly's Home Center, and the Digital Transformation Unit.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Revolution here on Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. My name is Juan McCartney. So good to have you with us. We are today going to be talking COVID-19. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. We have in the house with us renowned Dr. Peter McCullough, who is an epidemiologist and also has other degrees that I could never aspire to achieve, and a cardiologist as well. All right, and we also have with us Dr. Dinothra Archer, and we have with us also Andy Knowles in the house. So
not past Eddie Victor.
Oh, okay, Victor. You told me you were Knowles. I'm so sorry. Could we talk on the WhatsApp?
Yeah,
we
haven't met. All the time. Yeah, okay, we've never met in person.
I'm so sorry. All right. It's okay. I get stuff wrong with people's names all the time. Okay, so we got Dr. Dinothra Archer, Pastor Eddie Victor from Grand Bahama. All right, and we got Dr. Peter McCullough. And the reason they're here is because Dr. Archer and Pastor Victor, they're part of Optimus Bahamas, a group of committed medical professionals, church leaders, legal professionals, concerned citizens and residents who've banded together to promote an expanded protocol in the COVID-19 fight to save more lives. Optimus also believes in educating the Bahamian public on the most current evidence-based medical information in the COVID-19 battle, sharing preventative and therapeutic medicines that save more lives, and therefore are pleased to have world-renowned internist, cardiologist, and epidemiologist Dr. Peter McCullough here in the Bahamas with us this week to conduct a series of interviews and meetings designed to educate the public on the continued fight to save more lives. Also, April 5th through 7th, Dr. McCullough is going to be on different talk shows. He's here right now, as well as TV shows. The main event is tonight. It's a town hall meeting at 7 p.m. at the Church of God Auditorium on Joe Farrington Road. All COVID protocols will be observed. Over the last 2 years, Optimus writes, there's been a lot of misinformation distributed, a lot of truthful information withheld for different motives and reasons. Dr. McCullough will share the true science on what is the reality of COVID-19 today. We hope to address questions such as, should all mandates and protocols be dropped? What were the statistics on the side effects of the vaccine? What role should prevention play in fighting COVID? What preventative meds have been proven to be effective? These and many other issues will be addressed. Therefore, Optimus, like to invite all media outlets. Well, that's already passed. All right, the main event's tonight, 7 p.m., Church of God Auditorium, Joe Farrington Road. You can do question and answer. You can have it on YouTube, Facebook, Zoom. You can also visit OptimistBahamas.com for further updates and current information on COVID. All right, so that was a press release. So good. Now we can get into the nitty-gritty. Okay, so Pastor Bethel, well, Dr. Archer was trying to get a hold of me, but I removed Facebook Messenger from my phone because I can't keep track of all these different apps. I'm an old man. I'm getting up there. So originally, Dr. McClough was going to come for 1 o'clock, and they told me that we had someone had booked a paid interview for 1 o'clock, and so I asked you guys to come earlier, and now the paid interview says they're not coming. Oh, wow. So we can have as long as you want. We can talk about what's going on. Dr. McClough, welcome to the revolution. Welcome to the Bahamas as well. I've heard a lot about you. I think the most prominent thing I heard was when there was some outrage over Joe Rogan, the podcaster, the comedian in the United States, because he had you on and people were trying to like ban people. And I'd watched some of your stuff before, and they essentially tried to disappear you from YouTube, and I had to go seek alternate avenues of information. This sounds like I'm making it up, right? Like it's like this is a spy novel. I'm being perfectly real here. And so when they did the Joe Rogan thing, when they tried to scrub that interview, I went and sought it out, and you didn't say anything that seemed out of the pale to me. And I started to realize after I watched interviews with yourself and watched interviews with other scientists who they tried to portray as mad scientists who were anti-science and kind of just living in their own world, that there's just been a narrative that's been put out there. And anyone who tries to go outside of the narrative, I've found, they're quick to slap a label on so that you disregard them, disregard logic, disregard the scientific method, disregard critical thinking, and just go with whatever's being told. And you may find me a bit more extreme, although not totally nuts, but I've been very skeptical about all this from the very beginning. And you tell me what you think. From the very beginning, and I caught a lot of heat for it from the beginning throughout, I thought we overreacted, but I was willing to go with the overreaction for a while. So when we had one case of COVID-19, let me back up. We just had an election, right, in September. So four and a half years before that, we elected the worst prime minister the Commonwealth of the Bahamas has ever had. And he's a doctor as well. All right? He's a gynecologist. But he's totally lost, right? And so we all knew he was lost. And so my theory on what happened is that he sought to portray strength. We had a Category 5 hurricane a few months before that, and that was kind of waning, and people started losing confidence in him. And then the COVID-19 outbreak happened, and I think he tried to portray strength and decisiveness and all this. And so he followed, to the letter, all the most extreme advice that was being given about dealing with COVID-19, all the while telling us he's following the science, barely ever showing us any actual science that they had gleaned from the Bahamas. So we had one case of COVID-19 on March 17th, 2020, and we shut the country down. We closed all the schools, closed most of the businesses, went into a curfew, started locking down over the weekends, locked down all holidays. We were unable to go to the store to get supplies when we wanted. We were unable to get water and other things as we so choose. And at the beginning, I questioned all of it because I'm a journalist. And so I just question what people are telling me naturally, no matter who it is that's telling it to me. And at the beginning, we were unsure and we were a little afraid. I thought it was an overreaction. I didn't think that from what I was seeing, from what was coming out of China, from December, January, that everybody was going to die, and it warranted shutting down rural commerce. And throughout the pandemic, we just went from bad to worse. We started doing crazy stuff like alternating the first letter of your last name, right? Who could go to the store or not. We closed all the beaches, and then we started opening the beaches from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. You couldn't go exercise outside of your yard. We started, I don't know if you know much about the Bahamas, but quite a number of people don't have running water in their homes, right? Unlike industrialized countries. Okay, so a stay-at-home order isn't very practical for a great deal of our population because they have to go to a public pump to get water. So we started arresting people when they violated the curfews and the lockdowns, when they were going to get water in their homes. And so we also have a great deal of unemployment, particularly after we shut down all the businesses. And so before all the unemployment assistance started and before we were able to organize a food program, People were trying to sell wares on the roadside. We call them coconut boys. They would cut coconuts out of trees and sell coconut water. We drink a lot of coconut water here, which I got to cut back on because I got to work on my cholesterol. But they would arrest the unemployed young men for selling coconuts on the side of the road, all in the under the guise of protecting us from COVID-19. So the fishermen who would make their livelihoods by going out on the sea, you know, two, three of them on a boat and to fish, they stopped them from going to fish. All right. So the people who were farmers, they can only farm on their own farm, right? Acres and acres of land outside during certain hours. And that was only after they amended the rules, right? Because we were told all along there's no rule book. And so I guess they just figured that's an excuse to make it all up as they go. We were unable to visit doctors. Hospitals closed for all but emergency services. All right, all elective surgeries ended. Doctors' offices weren't able to open. People who were suffering from cancer, people who were suffering from diabetes, they weren't able to get treatment unless they went to the main hospital, and even then it was a wait. We banned visitors from seeing their loved ones in hospital. Mothers couldn't even see their children without special permission if they were sick. And we just kind of went along with it. A lot of us, because we just weren't sure what was going on. And so 2020 happened, and toward the end of 2020, we were told, just hold on, the vaccine's going to come out, and that's going to solve all of our issues. And so around the beginning of 2021, we started to see the United States, they were vaccinating people, and we were told, just keep holding on. And then we started vaccinating people here, and we were told, when you get vaccinated, that would be the end of lockdowns. Now it'll be the end of COVID protocols. Take the vaccine, because with the vaccine, you can't catch COVID. That's what we were told. The President of the United States said it. And you can't transmit COVID if you take the vaccine. All right. And we took the vaccine. It turns out you can catch COVID with the vaccine. It turns out you can transmit COVID with the vaccine. And the Delta variant came along, and it was very virulent. And we still, I believe, had an over-reliance on a vaccine. And as all this was happening, I'm just trying to express all my thoughts to you here at the moment. As all this was happening, myself, doctors like Dr. Archer and others were asking, what's the treatment for this? How is it that we're able to come up with a vaccine? Doesn't do what you said it would do, right? But how is it we're able to come up with a vaccine before anyone's able to come up with a sensible treatment? And all along, we were told that certain treatments just didn't work, and they were crazy people did these treatments. Ivermectin, Quercetin, all this other stuff, vitamin D. All right, we were told none of that works. The protocol here, and this isn't an indictment on the doctors here, but it's just what happened as I watched people suffer. If you caught COVID and you were experiencing some symptoms and you went to the hospital, their advice to you, the doctor's treatment was, go home. When you are unable to breathe, then give us a call. All right? And that's how a lot of that went. And as I was telling you before the show started, my mother was very sick when the COVID-19 pandemic started, and she wasn't able to get treatment, and I had to try move heaven and earth to try treat her. She still did not survive, right? But I should have called you, right? But at the end of the day, I'm trying to figure out how so many people get a pass for getting so many things so wrong, for damaging so many people's lives, for trampling over so many people's rights, for silencing people, for excommunicating people, for trying to scrub people's reputations like yours, just under the guise of, it's all new and we don't know what's going to happen. Because that was the first time in my life that I ever heard that. All right? I've witnessed many world events, and even when 9/11 occurred, this sort of reaction did not happen worldwide. And I've yet to understand what happened. And they tell me, well, it's the first time in 100 years. And I'm thinking, do we not know 100 years later how to deal with anything better than we did 100 years ago? And I sit here today, and I still wonder why we can sit in the studio and not wear a mask, but I go out in the hallway, I have to wear a mask. Why the office of the Prime Minister, you have to wear a mask to go inside, but the Prime Minister can sit with the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge with no mask. They can have a ball at the Bahamar Convention Center with hundreds of people, none of whom are wearing masks, but yet we still have mask mandates for the general public. But I'm not sure where you're staying. If you're at a hotel in the Bahamas, there are no mandates. All right? Except for the staff. Well, the staff are by choice, they say. Yeah. But you don't have to wear masks if you don't want to, and you're supposed to social distance. So help me out. I brought you from the beginning to the end. Let's go back to the beginning. How did this all start? How did we take this approach to this? Like, is this a normal approach to a respiratory illness? And do you think all of this was warranted?
I have to tell you, listening to all that, I think that's probably the best media layperson summary that I've ever heard.
Thank you.
And I have to tell you, I've been on with the best. I mean, that was really good. That was really good. That was well put together, and it flowed. And it was right. I mean, what you summarized was right. Let me just say, as an internist and a cardiologist, I maintain my board certifications in both. I do academic rounding on both. I'm trained in epidemiology at one of the best schools of public health in the world at University of Michigan, where the polio vaccine, a considerable amount of the work for the polio vaccine was developed. As a doctor who, you know, I've taken every vaccine that I'm supposed to. My kids have taken all the vaccines I'm supposed to. We follow the vaccine schedule. And I think we can celebrate vaccines like the meningococcal vaccine, which has effectively wiped out these meningococcal outbreaks that we've seen in colleges across the country. Polio, we don't have scourges of polio. I mean, so these vaccines, good ones that are developed, that are safe and effective, what have you, they become part of the fabric of medicine, and that's perfectly fine. What we know for respiratory illnesses in general is that the principles of risk stratification apply, meaning that for you to get a pneumococcal pneumonia or Haemophilus pneumonia or a mycoplasmal pneumonia is very different than your mother or your grandmother, right? So the susceptibility, so respiratory illnesses are always that way. We really worry about influenza in our 90-year-olds, and we have no concerns about influenza in teenagers, because the respiratory mechanics, the cardiopulmonary function, the resiliency, the immune systems are very different in these individuals. So that was the first overlay that, wait a minute, for respiratory illnesses, risk stratification applies. The second principle is that for all respiratory illnesses, we always treat them early. Even influenza will give combinations of Tamiflu or the other antivirals early. Pneumococcal pneumonia, we won't hesitate. We'll use forms of penicillin or cephalosporins very early or quinolones very early for pneumococcal pneumonia. There's not a single respiratory infection before COVID where we would say go home and let it fester for 2 weeks before you're on the verge of death. And we're talking about can't breathe anymore. You're right. You're getting pretty close to death before we would start treatment. Part of this was flavored, I think, by SARS-CoV-1. So the first SARS outbreak, remember, it was China, Canada, a few places. And I'll never forget, I put a call into Ottawa when this started to go down early in 2020. And I called a doctor up there, Manish Sood, a friend of mine. I said, what was it like with SARS-CoV-1? He goes, listen, this virus was enigmatic. We never knew how to treat it. The only thing we do is put people on the ventilators. And all I got to tell you is we wore N95 masks for 90 days, and then it literally just went away on its own. It vaporized. We never really had a vaccine. We never had treatment. And that was the program. So when we heard, oh, listen, let's just get to Easter and this thing will be over with, I think we are in that mode of SARS-CoV-1. And then we ultimately developed an understanding, listen, this isn't going away. This virus is moving around the world. The principles of risk stratification apply. We must have a treatment approach that would complement anything in the future, including vaccination.
Mm-hmm. So when it first started and they were talking about lockdowns, stay-at-home orders, self-isolation, did that make sense to you as a doctor?
Well, that's one of what we call the four pillars of pandemic response. So what happened over 2020 is I was feverishly working largely independently from the group in France, Didier Rialt in France, a group in New York, Vladimir Zelenko, groups in California. ultimately, we congealed on the same treatment principles. Others were working on contagion control, and they were largely the public health institutions. So one of the when I testified in the U.S. Senate in November of 2020, I laid out for America, and I had published, was called the four pillars of pandemic response. The first pillar is control the spread of the virus. Okay. Pillar number two is treat it early to avoid hospitalization and death. And by treating early, we also reduce the duration of infectivity. So we actually reduce the spread there. Pillar number three was do the best we can in the hospital. Hopefully we won't have people in the hospital, but we need to have hospital protocols. And pillar number four was vaccination. So on to pillar number one about reducing the spread of the illness. What was learned relatively rapidly, and the Chinese were helping us, is that this was not a contact virus. So it wasn't like staph. It wasn't, you know, on people's hands, what have you. And it wasn't droplet. So it wasn't tuberculosis. It wasn't people weren't coughing gobs of mucus on people. It wasn't droplets. It was actually aerosol. And aerosol meant the virus, in a sense, was in the air. And the Chinese were telling us through their publications that 85% of the spread is occurring within the home. So someone must have a long period of time exposed to someone else to have it spread. That's what was learned. What happened was this idea that the one thing everybody could do would wear a mask. And doctors bought into this. Honestly, I didn't think it was a big deal. I wear a mask anyway in the hospital. I go in a cardiac catheterization laboratory, I wear a mask, dentists wear a mask, nursing assistants, other people wear a mask. Like, what's the big deal in wearing a mask? In fact, all of our masks were raided out of the hospitals as people started to wear masks. As it shook out, there were 12 randomized trials previously, then including two in COVID, that showed generally public masking didn't work. Mm. This was largely known in 2020, 2021 for the following reasons. One, a mask expert, Stephen Petty, published the findings. 18% of the air moves around the mask. You can actually see it. So that makes sense. Another common sense thing. When people wear masks, they commonly fall off the face or they get pulled down below the nose or they're on one ear or people pull the mask off to talk or have a drink of water. So it's obvious if the mask is not on continuously and if air moves around the mask, it's not going to be effective. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the virus is found to be about 1 micron in size. Typical masks can filter out 3 microns. And so the fundamentals became in place that masking was going to be useless except in the hospital setting. Now, it turns out in the hospitals, in U.S. hospitals, we used reverse ventilation. And we were constantly taking patients down to x-ray and CT scans. So they actually had to leave their isolation rooms to go to these radiographic facilities. And we used masks. And it turned out the masks were fine, what we learned, in acutely sick people. So what I would tell my patients, say, listen, you don't need to wear a mask when you're outside and you're in fresh air or general public. I said, but if you got sick with COVID, please put on a mask and go home. And then once you go to home, take the mask off. We don't want people sick with COVID wearing masks by themselves at home because they're going to rebreathe the exhaled air and re-inoculate themselves. So when someone's acutely sick, you could almost envision a cloud of virus around them, and you want to dissipate the cloud. So one of the principles in my very first paper was what's called fresh air. We basically, when people are sick with COVID, we wanted them outside. I live in Texas. We could be on the front porch or back porch. Let the breeze blow that virus off you. The virus dissipates. There were papers from Singapore showing that it was nearly impossible to transmit the virus outside. And so one of the big mistakes you mentioned here in the Bahamas, and it happened in the U.S. too, is closing beaches. That's the last thing you want to do. You actually wanted people outside. You wanted them to get fresh air, sunlight, and only the sick people needed to stay in. So the big landmark, and we mentioned it off air before we started, was the Great Barrington Declaration. I think everybody in the Bahamas should know about it. It was authored by Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, who's one of my fellow frequent contributors in the major U.S. media, Martin Kolduff from Harvard, and Sunicha Gupta from Oxford. These are some of the best institutions in the United States, some of the most published public health people in the country, including Kolduff, who's a vaccine expert. And they basically said in Great Barrington as follows. Sick people should stay at home and quarantine, and if needed, high-risk people get treatment. Protect the seniors because they were the people at risk, and everyone else, go about your business and let the medical personnel focus on a narrow band of people instead of focusing on everyone. The mistake the government's made is they focused on everyone and they lost sight of the small number of people who are acutely sick right in front of them.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the greatest disservices that the COVID-19 protocols and all the missteps, one of the greatest disservices that occurred was what happened to children. All right, so, and people, you know, anyway, people were like, oh, children are resilient, they'll be fine, X, Y, Z. But it turns out they're not fine, right? So it turns out that now the American Pediatric Association is pushing back developmental goals for children. The reading age for children now has been pushed back because of COVID-19. The dropout rate of schools has been much higher because of COVID-19. Childhood depression, suicide has gone up because of the protocols of COVID-19, because they cancel team sports now. Health outcomes have become worse for children. And all the while, we were saying we want to protect our children, we want to protect our children. And I noticed how the messaging shifted, right? So first it was like, you want to protect the kids. And then it was like, well, and then when we saw kids weren't really getting that sick or sick at all in the first variants, we said that, well, you don't want the kids to go and get it and bring it home to grandma, and grandma's going to die, right? And you're going to kill grandma, so keep the child at home and make sure that they don't get COVID-19. It turns out that hundreds of millions of people still caught COVID-19. Several million people still died, and we're still left with the result. So I wonder, as a doctor, someone who looks at these things, was it worth it? Did we save more people than we ultimately harmed?
Definitely not. So very early on, they were producing models of what would happen if we were to lock down versus not to lock down. For some reason, we went with the more extreme models of locking down from the UK and different places in America. But there was a lot of information out saying what were the social and economic consequences of be with this. And a big part of it had to do with our children. We speak about always following the World Health Organization, all those places, but their recommendation was not to lock children down, not to keep children out of school, but actually to have children out there. And so it's somehow, like Dr. McCullough said, we got a lot of things almost backwards. So the children were the first to be locked down, in a sense, kept out of society. They weren't even allowed in food stores at one point in time. So we really did a disservice to ourselves, painting this broad stroke straight across. And we saw it in the Bahamas. We saw children that went missing from our schools. Over 40% of the children, they couldn't say if they were online or offline or whatever like that. We were seeing a lot of mental illness, depression, and anxiety. I see a lot of young teenagers coming in with anxiety. And so, you know, as they start to look at this data, in the UK, they found that the difference that probably was made by locking down was less than 0.02%. So we really didn't have an impact. All we did is create all of these problems, people not being able to get the health care they need, and now we're behind with our NCDs. People have gained weight. People didn't get treatment for cancer and other diseases. And so now we're dealing with all of this stuff that's happened, and it's going to be very difficult to catch up.
Right.
Very difficult. We put ourselves years behind, and there's more poverty in the world, more suffering in the world because of this. And like Dr. McCullough had said, we know what to do with a respiratory virus. So it was very unusual for me as a physician looking at how we were handling this and wondering why we were taking this particular approach.
You know, one thing I'll say is that children have tremendous immune systems, because as many will recognize, kids get colds frequently. So they have abundant lymphoid tissue in the throat and the sinuses. They have a gland actually in the lower neck called a thymus gland that is really a factory for T cells. T cells recognize the virus and actually present it to B cells, which make antibodies. T cells also, a certain version of them called natural killer cells, they just munch up the virus anyway. So children are considered an immunologic buffer. And what we had learned early is that the children were having very little impact with COVID at all. In fact, for some of them, COVID was less than a day of a drippy nose or a fever. And there was no credible evidence that children were spreading it to their elders. And we had data from schools. There was no credible school outbreak.
in the United States. In Dallas, Texas, our public schools, Dallas Independent School District, shut down. The parochial schools stayed open. There was no difference in terms of outbreak analysis across Dallas. So we actually had natural experiments suggesting the schools should have stayed open. The teachers in the United States and the teachers' unions were very vocal about keeping the schools closed. So this wasn't actually about the students. This was about the teachers. And for the first time in our society, we started to view children as, in a sense, human shields. Mm. And the idea of, well, let's do this to our children. There's some famous photos where there's some teachers standing behind a whole group of little kindergartners, and the kindergartners have the masks on, the teachers have the masks off. Right. And you started to see this idea that children were going to become human shields for all of the pandemic response measures. And that became, I think, a really contorted way for adults to think.
Yeah. And what I found interesting is they sued the FDA and Pfizer to release their findings, which they had tried to, keep secret. Pfizer's own data show that children have a 99.983% survival rate.
And right up until the age of 55, there isn't a lot of...
So what are they talking about? Now, we're going to talk about vaccines and XYZ.
But let's say one more thing about children, though. I want people to understand this, is that there are children who can get severe COVID. So there are children who have cystic fibrosis, which is a known congenital problem that affects the lungs. There's adult congenital heart and lung disease, diaphragmatic hernias, children with severe asthma. There are children with mental impairments of various sorts where they're at risk for aspirating saliva into the lungs, bedridden. So there is a vulnerable group of children out there. I think parents who are listening to this should, they'll know what I'm talking about. We have learned over time that COVID-19 is treatable in them. We use albuterol inhaler. We'll add what's called budesonide inhaler. Budesonide, supported by 3 randomized trials, very effective in reducing the inflammation due to COVID. We can use weight-based dosing of ivermectin in children very successfully. In the United States, we have the Pfizer and Merck drugs, which can be dose-adjusted. We actually have monoclonal antibodies. We've always had monoclonal antibodies in the United States. They came before the vaccines. They've always been able to be used down to children down to age 12. So it's really the teenager with cystic fibrosis who would get in trouble, for instance, or with adult congenital heart disease. We can use aspirin, limited dose aspirin, weight-based, as we would in other illnesses. We use azithromycin to cover other co-infections. And then lastly, if we ever need to, I've never had a need to do it in a child, use anticoagulants. But the point is, it's always been treatable. So when I look at the data on children hospitalized, the vast majority of children hospitalized with COVID they were panic hospitalizations. Parents panicked. The vast majority never needed to go on the ventilator. They needed some transient support in the hospital. And sadly, of the children who died in the United States, out of 70 million children, we had about 600 COVID deaths. Now, we have far more deaths, by the way, due to drowning, suicides, other things. So 600 is a small number. Of those, the vast majority had cystic fibrosis, leukemia, some terrible illnesses. And sadly, when you look at those deaths, virtually none of them received any treatment before the hospital. It was basically a manifestation of no pre-hospital treatment. Recently, the CDC has adjusted that 600 number down considerably. They've looked at the cases and said, you know what? They died of leukemia. They just happened to be COVID positive. Right. Or they died of a traumatic death. And so we even have fewer numbers of COVID deaths in children than we thought originally. And the point is, there should have been no deaths if we had an early treatment approach.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. Are we running into news, or are we going to break and come back? Break and come back? All right, let's do that. Because I want to ask you about the CDC as well. Okay, stay tuned.
One thing there is no debate about is that BTC has the best rates. Now, the best rates just got better because you pay half the price of the other guys with your BTC home internet and mobile services combined. Switching to BTC is a no-brainer because I pay less with BTC and get super fast internet with speeds up to 600 megs. The other guys, their internet only go up to 105 megs.
Get all the internet you want at half the price when you bundle your home internet and mobile. Visit a BTC store to make the switch today. Conditions apply.
Throughout our lifetime, we must all make decisions. No matter how we choose, the right one just needs to be made. Like having J.S. Johnson Insurance Agents and Brokers as your insurance partner. We've been serving the Bahamas for over 100 years. Whether you need home, motor, marine, or commercial insurance, make the right decision. Call 397-2100 or visit jsjohnson.com.
J.S.C., 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 J.S. Johnson Insurance.
Tired of banks forcing you to use technology to bank the way they want you to? Your convenience is important. So no matter what your banking needs, Commonwealth Bank's friendly staff are always available in branch for that personal one-on-one service. But when you choose technology, our online and mobile banking app offers you state-of-the-art functionality. The choice is yours. Commonwealth Bank. Bank the way you want.
Happy anniversary, My Gateway. Did you know that you can request and pay for over 35 government services on mygateway.gov.bs? Sign up today and access government services online with efficiency and simplicity. It's a celebration of a year of collective success on our digital transformation journey. My Gateway, making government work for you.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to The Revolution here on Guardian Radio. I'm Juan McCartney. We're sitting here with Dr. Peter McCullough. He's here with Optimist Bahamas. We got Dr. D. Archer here in the house speaking as well as Pastor Eddie Victor, who's sitting in on the interview with us. We only got a couple of minutes before we go to a break. And this is not to knock anyone in particular, but I just find it amazing that we've made stuff up. And then when we figured out that the stuff didn't work, we still kept doing it. So the rule where you stay 6 feet apart, that was based on how some other respiratory diseases spread, as I understand it. And MIT released their findings in a study in April 2021 and said the 6 feet rule is completely useless. And it doesn't matter if you're 6 feet, 3 feet, or 60 feet apart in an indoor setting, you have the same risk of contracting COVID. But we still did it. In fact, we just stopped doing it last month. And we knew from April 2021 it didn't work. So why do you think that is? Why do you think that we hold on to these things even though we understand they still don't work?
You know, why public health officials were not responsive to the data, that's the term we use, responsive to the data. Because at the outset of anything, we actually really don't know. But when the studies come in, and they actually make it easier for us. So, for instance, when the studies on public masking came in, and the Dan Mask study, for instance, it was done in COVID. There was a big study from Bangladesh. And we learned that public masking doesn't work, that would have been, that should have been the biggest relief. We can just drop public masking. Well, you know, people who are sick can wear masks, or people, obviously, if they're still concerned, can wear a mask. When we learned that it wasn't really a hand infection, it wasn't being passed by the hands, we didn't have to have buckets of hand sanitizer around. When we learned that it wasn't spread outdoors, you know, wearing a mask outdoors or prohibiting exercise, I'll never forget CNN had commentary by their medical correspondent castigating a man for jogging outside in San Francisco. And here's this guy jogging outside during a lockdown, and they're saying that he's a bad individual. And, you know, even common sense would tell you, you know, listen, if he's healthy enough to jog outside and the air is dissipating, that it's not, you know, it's not universally in the atmosphere. Not being responsive to the data, I think the public health officials will be held to that. I'll tell you a big one that really, really weighed in 2020 was the fact that the virus is not spread asymptomatically. So if people don't have symptoms, it doesn't transmit. That's really important. So understand, there was a paper by Cao from China, Madewell. Two papers showed this, that once asymptomatic spread was basically disproven, the assumption that anybody could shoot the virus at each other like lasers across the room. Once that was disproven, masks should have been gone. And then the other thing is testing. All this testing should be gone. I mean, I had to take a test to get here to the Bahamas. I don't have any symptoms. Asymptomatic testing is not FDA approved. It's not approved by any regulatory agency. The World Health Organization says don't do it. Since June of 2021, don't do it. So we have no FDA approval. We have the WHO saying don't do it. And yet, here we have countries, airlines, testing going on. We've had vignettes, actually, by Dr. Archer's husband, where he works in a job where he has to go from island to island. He was actually having to get tests going from island to island. Asymptomatic testing has no role. It should have been dropped. Not being responsive to the data, honestly, that's not my fault or your fault. That's the fault of our public health officials.
Agreed. All right, we got to take a break. We're going to go to news headlines. We'll be back on the other side. We're talking with Dr. Peter McCullough. It's very enlightening conversation. We definitely want to get to the vaccines. And I think the big question that a lot of people, including myself, have is how do we move forward from here and what the future looks like? So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas. This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, quality.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to The Revolution here on Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. My name is Juan McCartney. So good to have you with us. We're talking with Dr. Peter McCullough, who's here with Optimist Bahamas, and they're going to be having an event at 7 p.m. tonight at the Church of God Auditorium on Joe Farrington Road, talk about COVID protocols, mandates, vaccination, et cetera, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. If you guys want to call, you can feel free to call. I don't know if I'll get to your call right now. And you can express however you feel. You haven't been here, Dr. McCullough, but I've said this for the past 2 years that I can only explain how my thinking is based on the information that I have and based on what I'm seeing around me. And unfortunately, what happened with COVID-19 was a lot of it became political. We started to pick sides. Either you were for all the mandates and for vaccination and for all the other things that went along with it, the lockdowns, the curfews, or you were a science denier and you don't think COVID-19 is real and you're some sort of kook. And they kind of separated from Republican and Democrat. And I think we don't have any of that here, but our proximity to the United States helps us identify with a lot of that. And so we started a lot of that here. And so if you were for all the COVID-19 protocols, then you were for what the governing party was doing. And if you were against the COVID-19 protocols, then you were with the opposition. And you were being told from our prime minister that if you listen to the opposition party, then people will die. And that was the line he said over and over and over. If you listen to what the opposition's saying, more people will die. And that's how a lot of this was framed. So a lot of people got really baked into their positions on this thing. And they're in a position now to this day where they still see information contrary to what they were being told come out, and they won't accept what is right before their eyes. And it's okay, because people seek confirmation bias and people seek to validate their views, even if information comes out that is counter to their views. But what I think that we shouldn't do is just dismiss facts, right? And so we shouldn't dismiss facts, and we shouldn't accept things that people tell us in the absence of facts. So let's talk about vaccination. I'm vaccinated, right? I've had a plethora of vaccines. So I got 2 doses of AstraZeneca, and I got 1 dose of Pfizer as a booster. And initially, I had planned to take no vaccine because I could be called kooky, but I've been around long enough, and you're a doctor, so you've been around long enough and have studied this long enough to understand that though many modern pharmaceutical drugs have been an incredible help to mankind, there have been things that have been rushed to market that have been very detrimental to very large populations of people. And so my thinking was, I want to see how this goes. I want to see what the tests say, what the trials say, and then we'll see if we take it. And so I was very adamant about not taking it for a long time. Then they started tying vaccination to your civil liberties, and I decided that I would go ahead and take it. I'm 45. I had a good run. You know, I want to stick around for a while longer, but I'm going to take it, and I want to have more civil liberties after a year and a half or so of having them be very limited, and I'm going to take it. And then they started talking about kids should take the vaccine, all right? And they kept going on and on and on that 17 to 12-year-olds should take the vaccine. My sister lives in Texas, and where I believe you're from. And her husband is not vaccinated, and he works for the government in Texas. And he was very against their teenagers becoming vaccinated. But eventually, they convinced him to sign off on allowing them to be vaccinated. He was very concerned with the risk of myocarditis in his teenage son. And he was also very concerned about some of the other things he had read about the vaccines coming out. So who should get vaccinated? And do we see any evidence that vaccinating children is more of a benefit than a possible harm?
Let's just take the issue of status first. So when did you get Pfizer?
We got Pfizer in August, was it? I think August last year.
Okay, so You're unvaccinated.
I got one. Oh, when did I take the Pfizer?
No, you are unvaccinated.
You're unvaccinated.
If you look at the efficacy listen,
all the regulatory agencies are very clear on this. All the vaccine manufacturers are very clear on this. The vaccines only last 6 months, and then you're returned to unvaccinated status. So, Unfortunately, you were vaccinated, but you're not now.
Oh, I see. So you got to, every 6 months, you got to take top up.
Well, you know, they're already doing studies on the fourth dose.
Right. So the Israeli, but listen, it's clear. The vaccines only last 6 months, so now you're unvaccinated. So most people out there listening to this who think they're vaccinated or not, anybody who's not had a shot since October 1st is unvaccinated. And even if someone took it October 30th, they only have a month later of that status, and they return to the unvaccinated status. So in the United States, we have 330 million individuals. My back-of-the-envelope calculation is I think we have 250 million who are unvaccinated. The majority of people are unvaccinated.
Right. I think I had AstraZeneca earlier last year, and then I had Pfizer in December.
Probably.
So I'm
you
still.
Probably did it as your.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got about 3 months.
A couple
left.
Months, right? Yeah.
Okay, so you
well,
got
I'm not taking it anymore.
I know, but what I'm saying is, people think it's like a tattoo or it's a stripe that you do it once and you've crossed the threshold of being vaccinated that you have, and because it's been linked to civil liberties, which you pointed out, people think, listen, I've just got to do it. I it's like I've got to register to vote. I've got to get vaccinated. I need this civil liberty. What people don't realize is extremely time limited, and that's what's making people so disappointed in this, you know, love affair of being vaccinated.
Wow. Okay, so the efficacy of the vaccines, what does the data tell us? Like, do they work, or is it the fact that deaths have fallen and slowed down because COVID's already got who it's going to go get, who it's most dangerous toward, or is it because of vaccination, or is it because the variants appear to be getting weaker?
It's so hard. You know, our rules in medicine is that we always discuss safety before efficacy. We always say the S word before the E word. Why? Because it doesn't matter how good a medical product is. If it's not safe, it's gone. We don't use it. We do the same thing, by the way, in all commercial products. So it doesn't matter how much you like your car. If it's not safe, if it's going to blow up when you drive it off the lot, it doesn't get sold. So we always actually have safety first, before we ever discuss efficacy. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the vaccines are effective or not, if they're not safe. So that's the reason why that safety discussion is really important. And because of the vaccines came out under the emergency use authorization type of release all over the world, they were basically administered through government set up vaccine centers. They weren't bought and sold by insurance companies or bought and sold as commercial products. Emergency use authorization, or this release mechanism, of which we've had about a dozen products in the United States go through this process, we've actually never had a single product become a real commercial product that's bought and sold. We've had transiently the anthrax vaccine, which was used in the military, fizzled out and turned out not to be a winner. And otherwise, we've actually never had EUA products garner full approval. Now, you'll know when products get fully approved because they will be bought and sold as commercial products. There'll be a pricing assigned to it. They'll have what's called a full package insert. They'll actually have a full list of what the manufacturers say the products do, what the ingredient list is, what's actually in them. And then you'd have a full disclosure of what's called ISI, Important Safety Information. Those steps haven't occurred. So there's actually a belief system in the United States, and it was even said by our president, that Pfizer has been fully FDA approved. And later on it was said that Moderna. But they haven't, because the products are not bought and sold. There's no full prescribing information. And the letters that the agencies receive, it's all publicly known, they're basically what's called BLA letters, Biological Licensing Agreement letters, which say, listen, you can make a commercial product, but you have to do additional research. You have to research pregnant women and myocarditis. We have to negotiate a package insert. You have to tell us what's in the vaccines. None of that's happened yet. Mm-hmm. So we actually don't have any fully approved products in the United States. And if there's actually a paper that's just been published in the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, one of the major journals, that says changes in vaccine acceptance after full FDA approval, the title of the paper. So you can see how this really relatively large piece of misinformation mm-hmm. has been propagated through not only the general community, but even into the medical literature.
Yes.
So I got a question, and I am concerned about the impact on adults, but the thrust now is to, we don't have any of the doses for the, 6 to 12 or 5 to 12? We don't have any of those here, so nobody under 12 who hasn't been vaccinated in the United States in the Bahamas is vaccinated. And now they're talking about, in the United States they're pushing incredibly hard.
6 months. They want to go as low as 6 months.
And my kids are over 5. Is that necessary? I gotta honestly ask.
Let's just look at the approval. The vaccines, again, we don't have to, no opinion, it won't be your opinion or my opinion. Let's just look at the approval. The vaccines have won emergency use authorized approval as a method to prevent COVID-19 in someone who's not had COVID-19 before.
Right.
That's the only thing they're approved for. So if someone's had COVID-19, it's too late for a vaccine.
So how does that work? Is it natural immunity just as strong as...
No, it's just, honestly, it's just, that's just the approval. Listen, this is just the government regs. The government regs. So when the clinical trials were done for the vaccines, they strictly exclude people who've had COVID because, you know, the vaccine's probably going to cause harm in somebody who's already had it, and it does. People who had prior suspected COVID couldn't prove it. People with positive antibodies, pregnant women, and women of childbearing potential couldn't guarantee contraception. They're strictly excluded from receiving vaccines in the registrational trials for good reason. The FDA agreed. Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca agreed. They all agree. So where the violation is in the public messaging on this, that say, listen, everybody take a vaccine. And if you're pregnant, just go ahead and take a vaccine anyway. And if you've already had COVID once or twice, take it again. Take a couple more. The overreach of the vaccines from their approval, that's the problem. If you actually go back to the approval, what does it say these vaccines do? They say that they are an attempt to prevent COVID-19 in someone who hasn't had it. Now, in children, in the UK, the general accepted number in the UK is that 85% of the kids have already had COVID. They've already had it. United States, at our pediatric meetings in September and October, the talking point was 45% back then. Since our Omicron outbreak, my estimate right now is probably 85% of American children have already had COVID-19. So by the regulations, it's too late for 85% of all children. So we can talk about the 15% of children and say, what do the vaccines do there? And we would take safety first in what we know from the registrational trials, 12 to 17, that trial was done by Frank and colleagues published in the Journal of Medicine. The second one was Crother and colleagues, age 5 to 11. There, the vaccines caused about 20 to 30% of the kids to get pretty sick. I mean, fever, muscle aches, nausea, vomiting, miss time at school. We know in a paper by House and colleagues from the CDC, published in the MMWR, which is in their journal, the December 31st issue, for the first time we actually saw the V-safe data. V-safe data is the self-report data that the parents report what happens to their kids when they take the vaccine. And the number was roughly 15% of the parents thought the kids were getting impaired. They're having daily life impairment from taking the vaccines. So the safety data on the vaccines in children, just the acute things that happen in children, do not look good whatsoever. They look worse than getting COVID, just the acute things. Okay. On the efficacy side, the vaccines in the two trials I mentioned reduce the chances of COVID, the respiratory illness, which was very rare in the kids, and it amounted to basically a drippy nose, by about 90%. But it's that drippy nose phenomenon, if a kid has a drippy nose or not, is that worth, you know, 30% of the kids really getting sick? Now we add in the safety data on myocarditis, heart inflammation. June of 2021, the FDA comes out and says Pfizer, Moderna cause heart damage. Flat out. They just tell America it happens. Now the whole issue is, okay, how serious is this? The CDC says it's mild and that it's rare. And I was called on national TV to say, Dr. McCullough, you're a cardiologist. You're probably... you know, one of the most notable cardiologists in the world. What do you think? I said, listen, I've chaired data safety monitoring boards for big pharmaceutical trials. I know big pharma. I've done work for the NIH. FDA knows me. They know me really well. In safety data, we never assume things are mild or rare. What we learned, the CDC told us, is 90% of these kids are being hospitalized with this. That, by definition, is serious. If someone gets hospitalized, that's a serious adverse event. It's not mild. The kid was fine, and now they're in the hospital. That's serious, number one. Number two is rare. Wait a minute, we're not checking all the kids for this. This is just the kids that we know about. So you can't declare frequency unless you check everybody for the problem. So we actually don't know if it's rare. So I went on TV. I said, listen, I'm being conservative. This looks serious. And I think this is the tip of the iceberg. That's actually the right term. And sure enough, was I right. Boy, the papers started to pour in. We have 200 peer-reviewed publications now on vaccine-induced myocarditis. The cases are in the thousands. The cases are in the thousands. A paper from Kaiser Permanente from Scharf and colleagues have shown the rate that they're experiencing now is over 500 cases per million. The background rate of myocarditis, which can occur sporadically due to parvoviruses, adenoviruses, a idiopathic illness called giant cell myocarditis, is about 4 cases per million per year in kids. No. Now with the vaccines, now in the blanketing the vaccines, 500 cases per million per year. This is a dramatic change. Now Canada, the UK, and Australia has official guidelines telling doctors how to manage this problem, how to manage it. The kids cannot have any exercise whatsoever. If there's early signs of heart failure, we have to prescribe heart failure medications to children, which is really an unusual thing to do. ACE inhibitors, evidence-based beta blockers. We have to use prednisone and colchicine to try to simmer down the heart inflammation. And what we're finding is we have to go segment by segment, 3 months by 3 months by 3 months. And now papers have hit Schauer and colleagues, Jenny Schauer and colleagues, two papers in pediatrics that have shown the heart inflammation and damage doesn't go away. Doesn't go away. So at four months or so, the hearts light up like a Christmas tree on an MRI. It's called late gadolinium enhancement. That means active damage going on in the heart because the vaccines don't get out of the body. There's a paper that came in from Holkin and colleagues from Stanford showing the messenger RNA is found in the lymph nodes 60 days later. We never thought it was going to stay in the body that long. The spike protein that's produced from the genetic material, that's layered in the body for almost certainly over a year. Both the S1 and S2 segment work by Bruce Patterson at IncellDX has shown that. So we're in trouble. I mean, we're in deep trouble. The concern over children getting the vaccine couldn't be any higher.
Yeah. Well, so my question...
To tap into what he was saying, because you keep on hearing the world's mild and rare, and it makes you think. But as he put it in perspective... it was already extremely rare. So to go from 5 to 500 cases per million, that is a substantial difference when you look at it like that.
Here's what I find interesting. When you say something like that, that, okay, there's myocarditis, all right, or there's some sort of adverse effect, the rationalization usually is, well, if you catch COVID-19, there's also a possibility of myocarditis. There's also a possibility of some sort of blood clot or whatever. And I don't think that that makes a lot of sense to me.
No, it does. It does in this because people are trying to consider trade-offs. So there have been some publications on trade-off. One of the ones most frequently quoted, now fully published, is by Hogue and colleagues, Tracy Hogue, University of California, Davis, where she took an example of a boy, a teenage boy. Now, myocarditis, 90% is in boys, so it must be related to androgen receptors or other aspects of being a male postpubertal. And what she showed is that a boy who's age 17 is more likely to be hospitalized with myocarditis than actually ever be hospitalized with COVID-19 if they get COVID-19. The trade-off is actually against the vaccines. Ron Kostoff, has published in Toxicology Reports. And by the way, these papers were presented to the FDA in the September and October meetings. So this is in the public session. FDA did not dispute these findings. Very interesting. Kostoff showed that any person at any age is more likely to die with the vaccine than taking their chances with COVID. And the reason why it works out that way is when you take the vaccine, you can't get it out of your body. There's a 100% chance you got it. If you take your chances with COVID, you may or may not get it. If you get it, you may get a mild case. If you get it and you have a more severe case and you're in a good place with a good doctor, you'll get early treatment. You'll be spared of all this. So you keep factoring in those factors. It's actually a far worse decision to opt for the vaccine for both myocarditis and death.
You could even think about locally, Juan, the amount of children and young persons under the age of 21 who have really had severe COVID, and that would be a very small number. We really started hearing about young people in COVID when we started vaccinating and those side effects, and then they started countering the two. So I think we really have to think about those things when we're making those types of choices, but that information has to be available for people to make those choices.
Yeah. What I find very interesting is that there's usually this one set of things you can say about COVID-19, about vaccines, and everything else is dismissed as junk science. And I'll give you an example. So we have a guest who frequently calls 52, right? Mm-hmm. And 52 called last year sometime, and he was talking about how COVID-19 vaccines could affect women's menstrual cycles. And a woman I knew called me very upset. And how could you have this man come on talking about women's menstrual cycles and COVID-19? Has no idea what he's saying. And 52 reads a lot. I was talking to an OBGYN the other day, and he said he's seen dozens of women who have had their menstrual cycles impacted by COVID after they got vaccinated for COVID-19, and that there's growing research on the fact that it does impact it in women. And I think that one of the great strange mysteries I'm trying to unpack here is, why can we not say anything negative about vaccination if it's found to be the case?
You know, we just have to follow the peer-reviewed published literature. There's 25,000 papers on COVID-19, 25,000 papers. One of the pieces of information that came out was prompted by the Japanese. So when Pfizer went to Japan and said, we want to have our vaccines approved for emergency use, Japanese said, well, show us where these lipid nanoparticles go. And the theoretical construct was that the lipid nanoparticles would stay in the arm, the spike protein genetics would be taken up by the deltoid muscle and related cells, the spike protein would be expressed, we'd get immunity to it, the body would basically digest the lipid nanoparticles and genetic material, and we have immunity. That was basically the hope of the genetic vaccines. Now we've learned, based on the biodistribution study, that the Japanese made Pfizer do. Pfizer gave radio-labeled lipid nanoparticles to mammals, and they basically saw where the vaccine went in the body. And it was very disturbing. The lipid nanoparticles go to tissues that take up lipids, because they're doing it because they produce steroid hormones. They need the lipids. So the vaccine's actually hyper-concentrated in the mammalian ovaries, as well as the testes and the adrenal gland. Wow. Disturbingly, they went into the brain. We've never had a vaccine go in the brain before. So now, as you put all this together, wherever the lipid nanoparticles go, they are giving the genetic payload, the messenger RNA, with a code for the spike protein. The spike protein is the spine on the ball of the virus. That's the dangerous part of COVID. We're getting an installation of the genetic material producing the dangerous part of the virus in delicate organs in the body. That's the reason why it happens. The heart, if the kids are unlucky enough to get enough lipid nanoparticles in the heart, they'll get myocarditis. Same thing in the brain. They'll get tinnitus, all the various neurologic syndromes. The same thing happens for the adenoviral vaccines, AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. That's the reason why the FDA has warnings for Guillain-Barré syndrome, as well as the other neurologic syndromes. It's the lipid nanoparticles that bring a lot of the misadventure to vaccines, and in my view, have been the courier, if you will, of these side effects. So getting back to the gynecologic question, remember, pregnant women and women at childbearing potential who cannot guarantee contraception, strictly excluded from receiving the vaccines from a regulatory perspective. So that means a pregnant woman should have never received a shot. A woman trying to conceive should have never received a shot, period. I mean, the regulatory rules are hard and fast. So anybody saying, oh, here's a teenage girl, just take a vaccine, they're already violating regulatory law.
Yeah, I don't get that one. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. If the OBGYN has right. seen grown women whose menstrual cycles have been, how do you know what it does to
women going through puberty? I've seen women complaining of changes in their menstrual cycle, and even quite young women in their 20s.
It makes sense. The vaccine is hyper-concentrated in the female ovary. Now, there was a paper from China published before COVID showing that the lipid nanoparticles hyper-concentrate in what's called the corpus luteum, the part of the ovary that is regulating the menstrual cycles. That's where the lipid nanoparticles are going. It makes sense. You deposit the genetic payload, you start producing the spike protein, the body attacks its own cells. Now, the hope is it doesn't attack so many of the gametocytes, the cells that are producing the eggs, because if this produces attack on eggs and we lose eggs, a woman has only so many eggs and she's born with this. So as the vaccines hyper-concentrate in the ovaries, if women lose eggs, and we don't know that yet, then there'll be a clear link to freeze tube problems with fertility.
So originally they were saying, no, we don't think so. I did see the study that he saw in Japan where the Japanese said you have to kind of do these studies. We want to see where it's going. And I saw that study, and that was what really kind of alarmed me in that particular way. In the U.S., they had not quite reached that stage as yet, and they had to go back after so many accounts of women saying, hey, I think this is affecting my menstrual cycle. I've been feeling a bit different. I've had a few women who are post-menopause that they've had bleeding, and they haven't had a menstrual cycle for years. So these irregularities kept popping up, and they did take it seriously, and they do have a few studies up now in the U.S., where they actually looked at this and found that there is some association, but they're going to have to do more studies. And that's the thing right there. That's science. When there's something there, you study it, you find out more, and then you have to kind of look and see, what does this evidence mean, and do we need to do more research? Do we need to pivot from what we're doing? Does this now create more the type of information where we need to change our policies?
I got a question for you. So I got to ask you, as doctors, how does it square with your community when you're not all in sync? Because before I thought that doctors would agree to disagree and look at the science and that it would continue and you'd seek more information. Because I found this out about journalism, right? So people go, if I say I'm not sure about a COVID vaccine, right? They go, well, what kind of journalist are you? And I go, well, what kind of journalist are you? Because when you were talking about COVID-19, you only gave one side of things on science that isn't settled. And so because I'm asking questions about science that scientists can't agree on, how does that make me a bad journalist? So I wonder how, when you try to present things in an alternative light and looking at an alternative matter, how that comes across.
I think originally, I'd say for me, I've always thought that medicine was like an open field where we discuss. You know, it's all about hypothesis, analysis, kind of looking, you know, doing risk-based analysis on things. I think this is the first time when it's almost been kind of offensive to even bring up COVID at some times.
It's verboten to talk about what we're talking about.
It's just really, really, really
like,
odd.
People are going to be upset that we talked about this on the air.
Oh, I understand. People are really upset. But I think we're doing a disservice to our field if we're not able to openly have this discussion. Like, we should be having these discussions to decide what we're going to do, what policies work, and how do we move forward from this, because we all want the best for ourselves, our country, our patients, and everybody. So that needs to be more of an open dialogue. I would say that our community has not really done that throughout this pandemic, and we just need to open up that conversation and make it safe to have that conversation, because it's not always felt safe to have that conversation.
I would just add to that that disagreement or different viewpoints, that's the lifeblood of scientific discourse, is the lifeblood of medical progress. We're supposed to disagree. We're supposed to have to, we're different human beings. We're analyzing things differently. There is not broad agreement on back pain. You know, there's an entire discipline of chiropractors. They believe the best way to handle back pain is through non-surgical physical methods. There's spinal surgeons that think the best approach is to do surgery on every single back. I mean, we have broad disagreements, very broad disagreements on everything. What's happened in COVID-19 is just what Dr. Archer Cartwright said, is that we're not having the discourse. We're not having this conversation where we get invited and say, listen, let's hear pro and con. On, you know, the most contentious part of COVID, honestly, is the vaccines. And, you know, Steve Kirsch, who has started the COVID Early Treatment Fund, and then he's funding now the Vaccine Injury Treatment Fund, has an open offer. He's now it's in the Senate record. We testified together in the Pennsylvania Senate. His offer is this: any doctor in America who's CDC, FDA, NIH, or at a major academic medical center, who will come out and support the vaccines and actually, you know, get in a roundtable discussion and make the case that the vaccines are safe and effective, he'll pay him $1 million. Right. Or $2 million.
I said,
or $5 million. Or $10 million, and not a single doctor will come out and defend the vaccines. That should tell you something.
Yeah. I have found it. You want to say something, Pastor Victor?
Let me say something from a community-based perspective when it comes to the vaccine and what I've actually seen in Grand Bahama. I know personally two persons who got vaccinated and they died. One of them I had to officiate the funeral. He got vaccinated on a Monday in the United States. 1 week later, he returned to the Bahamas on a Saturday. On the following week, on the Monday, he died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And there has been a rash of sicknesses that have been taking place in our community. And we're coming to find out more and more these persons were vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So from a community-based observation, I have concerns as a pastor. Right.
Well, I too know numerous people who have been vaccinated who have died, but that doesn't mean the vaccine killed them. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I think you got to do a little more research, and in terms of a pathologist report as to what actually killed them.
Are we doing that research?
I don't know. I have no idea.
We have some points of reference. So most recently, a paper by Gill and colleagues from Connecticut, coroner's office, and it was backed up by the pathology department at University of Michigan and University of Minnesota, analyzed two boys, two teenage boys, took Pfizer, and they died on days 3 and 4 after the vaccine. They're found dead at home by their parents. The parents were horrified. They got autopsies. The autopsies confirmed the vaccines were the cause of death. It was unequivocal. It was fatal myocarditis. The kids didn't even have a chance to get CPR. Now there's been fatal cases reported by Choi in Korea and by Verma at Washington University in St. Louis. So I can tell you, myocarditis, beyond a shadow of a doubt, can be fatal in young people. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. After that, we have over 1,000 papers in the peer-reviewed literature, 200 on myocarditis, but on other problems that are fatal, including vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura, vaccine-induced blood clots, deep venous thrombosis that goes to the lungs, that's fatal. So it's biologically plausible that the cases that are being described, in fact, are due to the vaccines. And so there's been one causality assessment study done by McLachlan and colleagues, and it was published very early in the vaccine program, April of 2021, where they looked at the vignettes written in the vaccine adverse event reporting system, where people, remember, VAERS, 86% of the time is reported by a doctor, a nurse, a healthcare person who thinks the vaccine actually caused the problem. And he analyzed the deaths. They had 1,200 deaths. 86% of the time, by their independent analysis of the vignettes and coding them, independent doctors, 86% of the time, they concluded there was no other cause outside of the vaccine. Mm. So the causality, when we walk through causality of this, if this was a court of law, we would use what's called the Bradford Hill Tenets of Causality. We would walk through this exercise. We'd say, number one, is it a big signal? The answer is yes. There's thousands of people that have died after the vaccine. It's not a couple. Usually 50 deaths is off the market. In the United States, we got 14,000. The whole VAERS system, including U.S., Germany, and Japan, we think that's well over 25,000. It's a massive number of people dying. Does it happen? Is it temporally related? The answer is yes, it happens. 50% of it happens within 48 hours. 80% within a week. It's very tightly related to time. Number three, is it biologically plausible? Yes, I just walked through that. The spike protein that's produced by the vaccines is a killer. Is it internally consistent? Yes, there's lots of other non-fatal events that could be fatal, like heart attacks, strokes, myocarditis, blood clots that people survive, Guillain-Barré syndrome, transverse myelitis. Is it externally consistent? Do we see the same thing in the yellow card system in the UK and the UTRA system in Europe? Yes. The last thing we have, the last tenet of causality is, do we have any randomized trials? The answer is yes. The biggest randomized trial program we have is Pfizer. And in September of 2021, they came out with the data. More people die with the Pfizer vaccine in randomized trials than with placebo. So the Bradford Hill tenets of causality have been fulfilled on a more probable than not basis, and maybe actually on a clear and convincing basis. Those are two different legal standards. The vaccines are causing death in individuals. People are taking the vaccines, whether they do it out of their free choice or they're mandated to it, but they are facing the immediate risk of death.
We got to take a break. When I come back, I want to talk about the impact of COVID moving forward as the variants seem to change. I don't know that we should be less concerned, but it seems to be much, much milder now. Also, I will say this. I find it interesting that we don't talk about this, and if we don't speak according to the COVID Bible, then we're committing heresy. But there are countries that won't give certain people AstraZeneca, just will not give certain people Pfizer, but yet we're not allowed to talk about that. There are certain countries that won't give people Johnson & Johnson. Yeah. If you've had Johnson & Johnson, now countries are telling you, don't take it anymore. But yet we have the entire palette here, and nobody is allowed to talk about what other people are looking at. Yeah. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back. Yeah.
One thing there is no debate about is that BTC has the best rates. Now, the best rates just got better because you pay half the price of the other guys with your BTC home internet and mobile services combined. Switching to BTC is a no-brainer because I pay less with BTC and get super fast internet with speeds up to 600 megs. The other guys, their internet only go up to 105 megs.
Get all the internet you want at half the price when you bundle your home internet and mobile. Visit a BTC store to make the switch today. Conditions apply.
Children are a blessing and should be treated with love and care. They deserve safe, stable, and nurturing relationships, a supportive family environment, and positive social networks. Mothers, fathers, teachers, aunties, uncles, neighbors, Bahamas, let's do our part to stop the physical, sexual, and mental abuse of our children. Make the calls, file the reports, save precious lives. Let's join hands and hearts and say no more to child abuse. This message was brought to you by CFAL. Growing wealth for future generations.
Breakfast just got better at Wendy's. Introducing the Breakfast Biggie Bag. Enjoy a double sausage muffin with two square sausage patties, a freshly cracked egg, and cheese served on a toasted English muffin, a medium waffle fries, and an orange juice for only $5.25, fat inclusive. Add an apple pie for just $1 more.
Say what?
At Wendy's, better breakfast is all day. Offers valid in participating locations. Wendy's, different inside and out.
You do coffee your way.
Double shot, decaf, cappuccino.
Light roast, Colombian, no milk.
You do vacations your way.
Hiking boots, tent, mountains.
Five-star hotels and theater.
And now you can do insurance your way.
Online.
Email.
Chat.
WhatsApp.
Or in branch. For home, car, travel, boat, or business insurance, do it anyway with NUA Insurance agents and brokers. Visit NUAinsurance.com, call, or stop by a branch today.
I used to think of the bank as my personal ATM machine. If I wanted a new car, new furniture, a weekend trip to Miami, no problem, just max out the credit card or top up my loan. I was a big baller until I realized that 75% of my salary was going to pay back all those loans. Fidelity's personal financial coaching was the best solution. Fidelity gave me a plan with a debt consolidation loan that has a built-in savings that pays 5% interest. I now only have one low monthly payment, plus money in my pocket. Give Fidelity Bank a call at 356-7764 in Nassau or 352-6676 in Freeport. Visit any of Fidelity's locations or visit a website at fidelitygroup.com.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, quality. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Revolution here on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We're talking to Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Dinotra Archer, and Pastor Eddie Victor. They're with Optimist Bahamas. They're having a town hall meeting tonight at the Church of God Auditorium on Joe Farrington Road. And they were talking about concerns with vaccines, side effects. We're talking about COVID mandates and protocols. Sorry, I couldn't get to your text messages and your phone calls because I wanted to hear this. Because somebody texted me on my personal line. They're like, well, you should bring somebody on to debate what he's saying. And I said, well, this isn't a debate, though, because I've had, I want to say, 15 different doctors on this program since COVID or more. Since COVID started, and they all sang the same tune, right? Except for when the former Minister of Health, like, dared to say in Parliament that he was vaccine hesitant, and then he, afterward, he got about 10 shots after everybody came down. I don't think everybody came down and made him get the shots, but he said that. And then recently he said he has concerns about children and vaccines, and they were like, oh, here he goes again. In any event, I want to ask this as we move forward. Beyond vaccination, what can you do to make sure that your chances of catching COVID-19, being okay with COVID-19, are increased naturally? And also, is COVID-19, it seems like it's getting weaker. Should we be concerned that it might get virulent again?
We haven't seen any signs that it's getting more virulent. You're right, it's getting weaker. Last night I was on one of the major news programs here in Nassau, and you know I made a comment that the Omicron variant, which was so heavily mutated compared to the previous variants, it was so mutated that it allowed opportunities for subvariants or little mutations within the mutations or different configurations. So we have BA1, BA2, now we have XE, XF, and XD. They're all basically little variations of Omicron. The immunity to Omicron covers everything. In fact, it actually provides back immunity to Delta, which is wonderful. Omicron, in many ways, was a blessing. And the European Health Agency, it came out with a statement saying, listen, it's like Mother Nature's booster. It basically, almost eliminates the need for any boosters because in the United States, for instance, our CDC data was correct. 79% of Omicron patients were fully vaccinated. That should be a strong signal that the vaccines don't stop Omicron. I mean, it should be, and there was every paper published on it was true. I also presented the Israeli data on the fourth shot. On the fourth shot, you know, in Jamaica, you have just a handful of cases. On the fourth shot in Israel, 2 weeks after the fourth shot, they had 14,000 cases. Right. 3 weeks after the fourth shot, they had 9,000 cases. It should be obvious. Four shots, five shots, it's not working,
yeah.
Right? It should be obvious the vaccines don't work. I think people ought to, at some point in time, come to that reckoning. These large numbers effectively tell us the vaccines were a failed strategy. And so if they are not fundamentally doing anything to help us with COVID, all we can do is really focus on the safety issues. And the safety issues are, as we've outlined, alarming. Even if we just follow the regulatory concerns on safety issues, we would all be alarmed. People are weighing out the risks and benefits. People in my family took the vaccines, initially, I think, out of fear, out of patriotism. But what I think we don't want to see people do, as a doctor, I never want to see people do this. I don't want to see people taking a medical decision or taking a medical product because of social reasons, okay? In the United States, we have mandates. That means I don't want to see pills forced down people's throats against their will, and needles put in their arms against their will.
That's why I did it.
I mean, it's just, but we...
I'm with whatever, like the chip and all this, right?
No, but the idea, here's the slippery slope.
Right.
If you allow your sanctity of your body to be violated by some type of social norm or what have you, that circle is broken. It's going to lead to more and more and more. Bodily autonomy is, in many ways, that's all we have. If you can't control your body,
right?
What else do you have to hang on to?
Absolutely.
And so what you were saying, Juan, how do we deal with this? We really should go back to what we should have originally done, which is a risk stratification approach. And if we look at it, the people who were, especially earlier on, who were having problems with COVID, really had a lot of comorbidities. And we as a nation, you know, we've been fighting that for a while. So I think we should now look and take this opportunity to get ourselves healthy, to really push primary care, to really push a healthier way of life. Because even the CDC admitted that 75% of their severe COVID cases, these people had 5+ comorbidities. So these were sick people. And we do face a lot of problems with NCDs in this country. And we need to refocus that and streamline our treatment plan based on risk.
Steenkamp and colleagues, British Journal of Sports Medicine, showed the fittest and strongest people have the lowest risk of COVID and the lowest risk of ever ending up in the ICU or dying. Everybody can get more fit. Nutraceuticals and supplements probably play a role. They're not curative, but vitamin D seems to be an exquisite relationship between vitamin D supplementation and freedom from severe COVID outcomes. And everybody should have in the kitchen cabinet either povidone iodine or betadine or hydrogen peroxide, a dilute solution, half a teaspoon, 1.5 ounces of water, shot glass of water, squirt it up the nose, sniff it back and spit it out, and then gargle with the rest. That's what's called a nasal oral wash. That's very effective. 12 clinical trials, 3 large randomized trials showing it reduces the chances of getting COVID, transmitting it, or getting sick with it itself. This, the fact that it's a nasal infection, we must focus on the nasal passages first.
All right, we got to get out of here. 7 p.m., Church of God Auditorium, if you want to speak with Dr. McCullough, hear from Dr. McCullough on Joe Farrington Road. I'm happy you came today. I'm appreciating a different perspective on it. Because I know numerous people who have not had so much as a cold for 20 years, 30 years. They got vaccinated, they had problems, and they go, why is nobody talking about what could happen? And so I'm glad you were here to talk about it. All right? You guys take care out there. We'll be back, Lord willing, tomorrow. Have a great day, Bahamas.
Thank you.